We might as well get going. Remember on the website what we have up here, and also sent you the emails about the little lecture assignment. Not too crazy. Hopefully give you some points. It's supposed to be an easy 10 points. All right. Don't stress out. Maybe it'll increase the grades from lab grades. In the lab grades, I know some of them, you know, dipped. Some of them are okay, but it depends. If you have questions, definitely go see your TA and talk to them. Make sure you understand where you're missing points for the other assignments later on, too. And so this, so any questions on the lab, on the lecture assignment, generally easy. Some people emailed that aren't here probably about their don't know what to write about. Oh, my goodness. There are so many things out there to write about. All right, so pick something. But if you have ideas or something, you really need some help, I can give you a whole list of things. But basically, there's just pick something that's really interesting to you as well. And then you can scan the table of contents, like Journal of Neurophysiology, Journal of Comparative Physiology, and look at those topics. And some of those topics might strike an interest to you. Right? So that's an easy way to find topics in the latest breaking research that might be fun. So try to, you know, you have to submit that. Somebody submitted it, one through email to me, but, you know, you submit that on Canvas, right? So put that in Canvas so we have it. It's easier to look through. All right. And then we see down here what's happening before spring break, a little bit before spring break in case you're escaping that Thursday for some reason. So on that Tuesday, I think the 26th is Tuesday, right? Oh, that's after spring break. When's spring break? Oh, up there. Oh, sorry. This is due. No, that's what I meant. Oh, up here. Okay. Right here. It's still before spring break, right? 3-5. So it's not too far away. So class quiz, maybe a warning, right? For those on echo, you can hear that. And then before you leave for spring break, try to get that assignment done. Right, and then that way you can enjoy your spring break, think about things, watch the little sand crabs on the beach or wherever you go, all right? Good, and get that, and then finish that off, and that's to try to beef up some grades, right? Overall, you should get 10 points on that. All right, and then we are cruising through, we're going to finish up sensory today, and then we're going to get into skeletal muscle, and remember, you know, survey, we just kind of go through everything a little bit quickly, get you some idea about the content and then what we really need to remember leaving a comparative phys course. All right. So, we were here last time. So, are we all good? What we're going to do? We're going to finish up sensory, get onto muscle. Some of you might say, oh, well, I know about muscle, but there's some aspects that maybe is a little bit new. Okay, so I know this is hard to read in the back, but it's on your PowerPoints too, and it's in textbooks. And the general point here, what's the general point with rods and cones? Light activates it, right? So light comes in, activates this molecule, causes a conformational change, cis-retinol to trans-retinol. That then causes a change in the cyclic GMP levels inside the cell, right? So activates this transducin, activates phosphodiesterase, decreases the cyclic GMP, and what's keeping the sodium channels open in the dark, the nervous is the dark current, what's keeping the sodium channels open in the dark is cyclic GMP. So if you decrease the cyclic GMP, then the channels close. So if sodium is depolarizing the cells, if you close those sodium channels, what's going to happen? It becomes more negative, right? Less positive. So it hyperpolarizes. That's odd, very odd, right? Compared to what we've been talking about with sensory neurons in general. So it hyperpolarizes and then that decreases, isn't that odd? Decreases the amount of transmitter from the rods and cones to the next order neuron. All right? And then, yes?
How much of this pathway do you want us to know? Like, do you want us to know all the details?
Just kind of what we just went through, right? And the light activates cis-retinol, converts it to trans, activates phosphodiesterase, transducin then decreases the cyclic GMP, that cyclic GMP drop then causes the sodium channels to close, right, and then hyperpolarize. So if you could just write that down like bullet points, you've got it, right? And then because you might have an open response question, right? And you want to be able to have bullet points. And then that decreases the amount of transmitter release. So you could compare and contrast that to, say, mechanosensory stimulation, right? If you stimulate mechanosensory stimulus on your skin, what's the difference between these two kinds of sensory neurons? Generally, the big points, right? Stretch-activated channels versus the second messenger cascade system, and a decrease of transmitter instead of an increase in transmitter. And then the general idea is in the retina, there's this real network of neurons that can modify that signal, and then that relays it through the bipolar cells. And then finally, what to remember is that there's horizontal cells and amacrine cells in there. But then the depolarization, or the final activity on the ganglion cell, is what leads it into the central nervous system, makes up the optic nerve. All right. So I know there's a lot of text in there, but if you got that general flow down that we just went through, you are going to be fine. All right. There's a lot to the eye. We've talked about rhodopsin a little bit and the different colors with the cones and the three color types. We've already mentioned that, and about color blindness. Blue, green, and red, right? And we've talked about it, adaptation, I think. And, oh, one other thing we haven't hit yet, and we're going to get to some of the anatomy, is vitamin A. You know, your mom tells you to eat carrots because it increases your vision. She's partly right, because the vitamin A in there, right? So people with vitamin A deficiency have a problem with vision because of the lack of the vitamin A is that structure that helps for the retinol that's inside of your eye. Alright, so vitamin A is important. And we'll go through this anatomy of what we have to know. It's just all written out here from the PowerPoints of the text. But what do we want to know? This is where we left off, about the visual fields, right? And we did that blind spot in the lab, right, with the paper, and that was projecting to that spot of your where your optic nerve leaves the retina. But your left visual field, right, your left visual field, like the red over here, goes to the right side of your brain, and the right visual field goes to the left part of your brain. And that optic chiasm helps to direct the left and visual field. Now, it's really neat. We're not going to go into depth here, but if you're taking an anatomy course, this is so cool, because when people lose visual fields, for example, like they can't see the left side, where's the lesion? Is it in the eye itself? Is it somewhere over here, or somewhere back here, or somewhere in the visual cortex? So a neurologist will actually go through all these visual experiments, and they can pretty much pinpoint where the problem is. It's really amazing that they can work that out, because the anatomy is so well worked out in the visual field. You don't have to worry about that. We're not going to go through all this chaos. But with the part that I did leave off about, and it was running a little bit late, I remember, on Thursday, it was right here in the lateral geniculate. You get that competition from the left and right eye. So just to reiterate that, that was to synapse on those postsynaptic targets, right? And there's competition between these neurons to find that postsynaptic target in the lateral geniculate. If the right eye is dominating, it will take over more of that postsynaptic site, and it will inhibit the other eye's neurons from the ganglion cells going to that region. So that competition goes out throughout your whole brain, right? It goes out through your, not just your visual cortex, it also goes through your auditory cortex, and as we mentioned at the end, it actually is your sensory, somatosensory cortex as well. So we left off about those pathways and the connections in your brain have what's called critical periods. So the key element is critical periods. You might have heard that in ecology. Anybody hear that in ecology, critical periods? No? Yes? Maybe? Forgot it? Yes? Okay, critical periods, really important, because we talked about infants' brains developing, right? Very important to hear auditory input, mechanical proprioceptive input, visual input, because that is what develops the brain. And so it's really quite important. If you get these connections right before they reach a critical period, so what's the critical period? Is when the plasticity decreases, when it's not so plastic anymore. All right? So the nervous system's pretty much set in its synaptic connections in the circuitry. if you correct things ahead of time before the critical period, then you can make compensation for the lack of activities during earlier in development. What's another good example of this? Go back to our favorite animals, crustaceans, right? So did I already mention about the crustaceans, lobsters, claws, cutters and crushers? No? Oh, it's so neat because it feeds into our next chapter, too, on muscle. Okay, we always have to go into lobsters and how to remember this critical period. So Boston University has a program called BUMP. Summer, you can apply to summer programs there, Boston University, if you want to go out to the East Coast. And they take their students down to Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, which is down by Cape Cod. It's a famous marine biology station I kind of keep telling you about. Apply to these programs. They're really cool. Usually you get a fellowship, and you just have to get to those places and do it. But Woods Hole is a fantastic place. Over 100 years of research going on there. So they go down to Boston, from Boston University, go down in the summer, spend the summer down at Woods Hole, and work in research labs. And some of the work that was done in the 1970s was with lobsters. And they have a lobster hatchery out on Martha's Vineyard, a little island that's out just from Cape Cod. And they were interested in these lobsters. How do they develop? Next time you go to Kroger, I think the Kroger on Euclid stopped having them, the lobsters, but now you can see them in the frozen section. But the Boston Kroger still has lobsters. So sometimes in our neurophys class, we had to use lobsters. So I'd go out and get them, and then they'd have a lobster cooked out, or somebody in the lab would get a lobster tails. All right. But the idea is that those claws, if you look at the claws, go look at them. They're really amazing. One of them is a crusher, and the other one's a cutter. What do we mean by that? They actually have morphological differences. If you look at the teeth on the lobster crusher, it's like your molars. They're big, they're wide. We call them teeth, but it's really just a change of the cuticle, right? So they're big and wide. And then if you look at the cutter, what we call the cutter claw, those teeth and the claw is thin and narrow. And they have real sharp teeth, like your incisors. So real sharp teeth. You don't want to be having your fingers around them at all. And that's why they put those rubber bands around them also, right? Because they can hurt you. So lobster catchers, like in the East Coast, they usually say they wave kind of funny because they might only have a few fingers left. And the reason is because they've probably been picked by lobsters. And if those lobsters, like on the crusher, do get a hold of your finger, they can crush your finger completely off. That's how strong their claws are. Very strong. So there's kind of like blogs about it. If a lobster ever grabs a hold of your finger and like you're working with them for research, is to throw it on the ground as fast as you can and step on the claw with your foot and break open the claw because you're going to lose your finger otherwise. Right? So it's kind of important in that aspect. So if you ever go to Kroger and you see the lobsters, you know, keep those little bands on them because it can be quite dangerous. The point is, how do they develop a cutter and a crusher? Compared to your crayfish, if you look at your crayfish, you don't see any differences in the right and left claws, unless it's a regenerate. But they both look the same. The teeth look the same as well. So they're symmetric. But the lobster and some other animals, crustaceans, are asymmetric in their claws. So the researchers wanted to figure out why does one develop a cutter and one's a crusher. So they look at all these different lobsters, and it doesn't matter. Sometimes on the left side is a cutter, sometimes the right side is a cutter. And they found about 50-50. But how does it develop that way then? So what would you do as an experiment, do you think? Let's see what they did in the 1970s, and they answered this question. Any ideas? NIH wants to know this because this is maybe setting up plasticity about why you're right-handed and why you're left-handed. And maybe we can answer some of these questions by looking at simple animals like a crustacean. Ideas. You need coffee before you come to class, right? I know, you're just waiting for me to bring in Starbucks carboys. Any ideas? Excite you? No? Who cares about lobsters? I just want to eat them. All right, so what would you do? Yes.
Manipulate hormone levels during development.
Maybe hormone levels in development. Ecdysone is a common hormone that we'll get into when we talk about endocrine later on, too. So that could be maybe growth hormones or something like that. But kind of what I mentioned about sensory use, right? Think about what we were just talking about, critical periods and sensory use. How about, and maybe I didn't give you enough information. If you pinch on your crayfish or lobster or crab at the base of their leg, they will autotomize their leg. They donate it to science. It happens on all their legs, right? So we always say they're donating their leg when we take a leg off with lab, in the lab when we're doing stuff. And you don't have to kill the whole animal because they'll regenerate their claw back. People have studied that for a long time. Actually, T.H. Morgan, this building is named after Thomas Hunt Morgan, right? The geneticist that got the Nobel Prize. He was a student here in the early 1800s, and around 1901, he published an article on regeneration in crab legs and in lobsters. In, where was he? At Woods Hole. All right, so pretty neat. So he published a lot of work on regeneration of crustacean limbs. Also planaria, when you cut it up, how do they regenerate? And then he got off into Drosophila and followed up on the genetics and got the Nobel Prize, right, in genetics. And so his earlier work about this regeneration, too, was very interesting. They knew that animals, crustaceans, could regenerate. So the idea was, what if we take these kind of larger lobsters and pinch their claws and have them cut off, you know, donate their claw to the cooking boil pot and the other one, and let's see what comes back. So they did that. With the older lobsters, the cutter would come back as a cutter. The crusher would come back as a crusher. Well, that's kind of interesting. Then they started working with younger lobsters. And when they worked with really young lobsters, they could already see the differentiation starting. But if you pinch that crusher off, the cutter, when it molts, would turn into the crusher. Whoa, what's happening? And so that was kind of interesting. And then when this regenerated, it would come back, it would come as a cutter. So they found out something that was really neat. There's something about there that changed over, but it didn't change over in the adult. So then they thought there might be a critical period in the development. So here's some work in the 1970s about critical period development and the asymmetry of lobsters affecting the nervous system, but only changing the cuticle structure also. So to take a kind of a long story short, because we could talk all day about lobsters in this project, is that what they did is they raised little lobsters in tanks with nothing to play with, nothing to, you know, pinch, just a smooth glass tank, and just one per individual. And then they had these students from Boston University go in and exercise. This group would only exercise the right claw. This group over here, let's just exercise the left claw. Let's see what happens as they mold and develop over the summer. The ones that they exercised, the claw they exercised, would always turn into the crusher. Wow. That was interesting. And then they could pinch those claws off and see what happened on the regeneration if they now exercise the other one. They could get them to switch over, but only up to a juvenile stage. As soon as it passed this juvenile stage, they would always come back as a crusher or always come back as a cutter. So they found the critical period and the asymmetry development of that. Now, why is that interesting? Think about it. Exercising, you know, one side, sensory input, going to the brain, changing how that structure changes in development for the next molt. And when they molt, they shed their exoskeleton, right? And it changes the teeth structure on the cuticle. But not only that, for the next chapter, what we're talking about is the muscle. What's in the crusher versus the cutter, the closer muscles? The closer muscle in the crusher is slow phenotype. It's a slow muscle phenotype. And you can actually look at that on a SDS page gel. You can actually look at the different myosin forms. On the cutter, that's fast muscle. You know, fast muscle. So somehow that sensory input went into the brain of the animal, changed even motor activity, and that motor activity is thought to actually change the muscle phenotype. That is pretty neat, right? Can change the muscle phenotype from a fast muscle that would be generating to a slow muscle phenotype. How about you? Can you change your muscle phenotype? If you were exercising, let's say you have a lot of fast muscle in you, right? So you're good at sprinting, right? You can sprint really fast. But now you want to become a long-distance runner. So now you start exercising for a long-distance running. And you take a biopsy of your muscle before you start this, and you say, oh, you already got a lot of fast muscle. And now you started training over the whole summer for long-distance running. You're running marathons. And now we take another biopsy of your muscle. Have you switched your phenotype? A question that's really important, right, for health and benefits and athletes. What do you think? Anybody have an idea? Anybody exercise here? Anybody an athlete in the room? Yes, well, let's see. Anybody? I think you're an athlete back there, aren't you, in the blue shirt? No? No, you? Aren't you? Tall, you could be on the swim team. Used to be. Any idea about muscle phenotype? What do the swimmers have, generally? Any ideas? Okay, all right. We'll see. So, yeah, the point is that you really can't change your phenotype. So the take-home here is you really can't change your phenotype of your muscles. But you keep the exercise, and your muscle won't atrophy as fast. And so we'll get into that when we talk about muscle. Yes?
Couldn't you get more mitochondria in your muscles or something like that?
Mm-hmm. You could build up mitochondria and make them more efficient with exercise, definitely, right, and biochemically. But it's not doesn't change the myosin phenotype. Okay, so that's kind of interesting. And so that's just the exercise itself. But here we have this changing plasticity in the lobster model that we just talked about. We'll get more into that later on, too. So that's really neat. So sensory input, critical periods, what's the take-home here? Sensory input affecting the input into the nervous system could change motor output, but there's a critical period in those connections, in the plasticity of those connections. Now, let's go to the next crustacean model. The fiddler crab. Not all fiddler crabs, but some fiddler crabs. If you ever seen a fiddler crab, they call fiddle because the way they move their arms. One claw is really big and kind of accentuated. It's so big, it doesn't really function. It doesn't help them for eating or anything. But it might help for maybe defense. But the little claw, the other side, is a little claw, just a tiny little thing. So they've got this big claw. But what they've noticed is this, for the males, is that that big claw is the attractive signal for the females. So they wave the big claw, and the females will be more attracted to the male with the claw that is large, compared to if they've maybe gotten fights and lost their claw, then that claw is smaller. And the female, if they pair them up, aren't as receptive to the animal with the smaller claw. But what they found out about that, so it's behaviorally, like the peacock thing, but the other idea is then if they pinch off the large claw when the animal molts, the little claw will actually turn into the big claw. And when it regenerates, then it has a little claw on this side. And that can happen in some of the fiddler crabs throughout their whole life. So some of the fiddler crabs have neuroplasticity throughout their whole life. But other fiddler crabs, they don't change. What's the difference? But not only that, if you look at the brain of the animal, where the input comes in, where the big claw is, they have more sensory hair cells on it. So that part of the brain is actually larger, that half, than the other half. It's because so much sensory input's coming in. And that means the motor neuron, the dendritic tree of the motor neurons and inner neurons, are increasing in size too. But then you pinch it off, and it atrophies. And now a little claw develops. So that brain is changing throughout the whole animal's lifestyle or lifetime compared to some other fiddler crabs. What makes that difference? So this is why people study these kind of things. I know, it's like, well, you know, not too interesting. But maybe if we understand how that works, then we can understand why our nervous system doesn't regenerate really well, or maybe some of the key factors that could stimulate it to regenerate. Okay, so we went through a critical period. We went off on a big tangent, but you can understand what we've talked about with the visual system. So we mentioned Hubel and Diesel got the Nobel Prize for this because when they worked with kittens and monkeys, they realized this had a direct influence on humans and when to treat like the wandering eye in humans. But not only that, there was the fundamental principles about critical period and development of the nervous system and the neural circuitry and understanding other sensory modalities as important as also. And they've now known that visual input and auditory input, that those connections in your brain, like when you hear something, you look at it, or you look at it, you can relate with your auditory as well, that those connections between sensory modalities actually have critical periods also. So that's really quite neat. So if you have little ones, play with them, exercise them, give them all the sensory stimuli you can, because it's helpful to their brain development. That's the take home of that. Okay, and then we're going to get into a little bit about some insects in different kinds of eyes. We talked about the squid eye in the back of the retina, right? We did that in the lab, about the optic nerve leaves the back of the squid eye so they don't have a blind spot. That's kind of interesting. All right. And this compound dyes, these are really neat. These also use rhodopsin, this kind of pigment that can absorb the light. Let's see, I think I got a picture of it. No, I don't. The take home here is sometimes if you have a different textbook, you might see more details on this one. But the point here on the compound dyes, these little wider compound, as we say, these little facets, they have multiple ones. It's like multiple, you put all your fingers together, that could make up, and you point it out, that would be like your compound eye of an insect, if you've ever seen a magnification of it. So each little finger is an ommatidia, okay, an individual unit. Light comes in that ommatidia, and it's not scattered to the other ommatidia. It comes right into that single unit. And there's a lot of research that's gone on into insect eyes, particularly Drosophila eyes, because of the developmental aspects, but also genetics that you can play with and how the ommatidia develop. Okay, but the difference is the sensory neurons that receive that light, they actually depolarize. So you see that on old test questions? What's the difference of the sensory cells that receive light in a compound eye compared to a vertebrate eye? Is that in the ommatidia, in the compound eye, they depolarize, whereas in the vertebrate eye, the rods and cones hyperpolarize. So these are more understandable in the sense of what we've covered before. They depolarize, release transmitter, that goes on to the next neurons. We talked about the compound eye of the mantis shrimp, in that depending on how those layers are in the eye, they can actually polarize the light, like wearing sunglasses. So that's really kind of neat too, and you saw the little video that we had. So what do you have to kind of know about the eye developments is that, like we mentioned before, simple eyes, like an eye spot, that you can go all the way to the very complex eyes, like our eyes, the vertebrate eye, or the cephalopod eye, and you actually have a lens that can focus the light, and that lens can change its shape based on the muscles around it, right? And that can take the focal point that's far away or close up on the back of the retina. You have in the advanced eye, like ours, mammalian eye, you can actually change the diaphragm, if you will, around like a camera shutter. You can change that and alter the amount of light that comes in, so you can increase your sensitivity or decrease your sensitivity with the amount of light that's in the room. And you have a spot that's not shown here, but where you have a high density of what? For the focal rods or cones? Cones. So where you focus your eye, you would have a high density of cones for focusing, and those are for color, and out in the periphery you have more rods for black and white. All right, and that's the kind of the take home of a lot of that kind of recapping. So the horseshoe crab, another beautiful animal. It's not really a crab. It relates more like an arachnid. It's more like a spider. If you ever get to Newport Aquarium up in northern Kentucky, go to the Newport Aquarium on your break, spring break, if you can't get to the beach, and go play with the horseshoe crabs. They're really cool. But watch out when you put your fingers underneath them. They have little mouth parts that can bite you. So be careful. But you can pick them up and touch them. It's really quite neat. Look at their compound eyes. They have really neat eye structures up here. And they were used for research for a long time, not only for visual research, but for immunology. A good course to take. Some people might shy away from it. But immunology, anybody have an immunology last year?
I'm in it right now.
You're in it right now? How was it?
I love it.
You love it?
It's absolutely fascinating. It's hard, but it's really interesting.
Okay. How about you? Did you have it last year or now?
Last semester.
Was it okay? It was all right. Not super exciting? Just okay? Did you learn about more stuff about your own body? Kind of? Okay. But it is really cool. Like, I think it's really cool. Right? Because there's so many bugs out there in the world, right? And how do we defend ourselves from all that stuff and the comparative aspect and the evolutionary aspect. But a lot... Did they talk about the horseshoe crab in immunology? Okay.
We pretty much only talk about people.
Okay. Ask them about horseshoe crabs. You got to ask them about horseshoe crabs. What's so unique about horseshoe crabs? All right. Because the horseshoe crabs are phenomenal. And... you know, prod them. And you can find it online, too. Horseshoe crabs, there's old pictures of them in marine biology place at Woods Hole where they have piles of horseshoe crabs. I mean, gigantic piles. And you think, oh, all the poor horseshoe crabs. But what were they doing? They were injecting bacteria into horseshoe crabs. And they had such a great immune response that they could fight off the bacteria. and they wanted to know how can they do that. And these are the masters of an immune response, an innate immune response, not building up antibodies, but an innate immune response. How could they handle this bacteria, knock it out really quickly? And these are very ancient animals. So, you know, if you look in the fossil record, they go way back, right? So maybe there's something really unique about it. So there is. And they worked out a lot of how these animals fight off bacterial, viral infections. And by looking at them, they're trying to understand how humans could maybe fight those off. So really quite interesting. But what else is interesting about them is they would take the blood out of them. So these animals have blue blood. It's like your crustaceans. They have a hemocyanin as their respiratory pigment, not hemoglobin, but it's a hemocyanin, and in the light it looks blue. What would they do is they will drain the blood, about a third of the blood volume, and there's places in the East Coast that are set up as a factory setup to drain blood out of horseshoe crabs. So they collect these crabs, put them on little racks, put needles into their abdomen, and drain the blood out. And they put them in little jars and collect the blue blood. And then about a pint of that, I think, goes for, what did we look? We looked it up at one time. I think it's $10,000, something like that. And you think, whoa, that's a lot of money, right? What do they do with it? They then use that blood to do what? They lyse it, and they get out the response that would cause it to coagulate the bacterial infection. And where would they use that? Why would they use that? Do you know why they use that? To test that on prosthetics that they put into humans. It is the assay that Eli Lilly sells to actually test on artificial hips, artificial knees, on those metals to see if they're clean of bacteria, particularly gram-negative bacteria. Is that not wild that we use horseshoe crabs to test implements that go into humans to see if there's any bacterial infection in their processing of those limbs? I'll send you the web link with this. It's so cool. So how did I figure this out? I didn't know about it, actually, until about last year. And it was so bizarre. I'll just tell you how bizarre it is. Why you want to read outside things. My mom's like 94 years old. She gets a little Audubon magazine, all right? And so I'm flipping through it, waiting for dinner or something. And then we're looking through this thing. And in the back, there's a little article about this bird, an ornithologist, that was wondering why these particular birds were decreasing in their population. Did I tell you the story yet? No, I didn't. All right, that's great. So this is why you want to read everything that you get. Oh, hands off, just absorb everything. And they were wondering, why is there a decrease in these birds, these migratory birds? Well, he noticed that in the East Coast, that these birds would land there and eat the little baby horseshoe crabs. Then when the crabs come up and lay their eggs, and then they would have these. Well, he noticed that this bird population is dropping out. Why are they dropping out? Is it poisons? Is it something on their flight? Well, he found out the decrease in the horseshoe crabs. So he wondered, why is there a decrease in the little baby horseshoe crabs? And then he found out that these people are collecting the big horseshoe crabs, the mothers and the dads, right, for the little babies, and bleeding them out. And they would bleed them out and then throw them back in the ocean. But sometimes, if you're making that much money, would you just take a third of the blood? You know, you get a little bit more, you make more money, right? It's very expensive. So they were taking more blood than they really needed to out of these horseshoe crabs and threw them back in the ocean, so their populations were dropping. And that then affected the babies that are born, and that affects the birds that would be coming back and forth for migration. So he looked at that and found out, why are they taking these big crabs, and found out that Eli Lilly in Indianapolis was paying these people money to drain the blood out. So he contacted Eli Lilly, and they worked out a new assay where they don't need to take the blood anymore. Another assay that's very sensitive to gram-negative bacteria, where now they don't need to drain the blood out of the horseshoe crabs. But this all became of an interest because this ornithologist was wondering why the bird population was dropping. Is that not cool? That is so cool. But guess what? Now they're protesting in the East Coast because these people are losing their jobs for not grabbing the horseshoe crabs and draining the blood. So you see how one thing affects the other. It's really quite amazing. But the history of them is fascinating. For the visual system now, people use the horseshoe crabs for many years. They used to be lab experiments, but they're so expensive to get these horseshoe crabs that we don't do them anymore. But you can cut the cuticle out of the carapace here and get a whole eye, a whole compound eye. Why is that so important? Because they could take this out like that, and they could record from little nerves that come off of the compound eye. And what they found out was something really interesting, which is in the next slide, I hope. No, it's not. Okay, I'll just leave it up here. Okay, so what they found out is if they record on some of these nerves that are farther down on the nerve over here, and they could record from a few omatidia, and they could shine light right here. So really a pinpoint light right there. Okay? So let's shine a bright light here. Let's just give some intensity to this bright light. Let's say 10, whatever that unit might be, 10. But if you shine a brighter light next to these, that one, and you shine a brighter light over here, let's say 100, whatever the unit might be, you can shut down the activity in the nerve that you were just recording. Whoa, what was going on? But the activity from where you got the brighter light would increase in activity. What they found out was there's, in the compound eye, at the base of this, there's lateral inhibition. So where the stronger signal would come in, it will inhibit the neighbors. So wherever the stronger signal is dominating. Why is that so important? Well, that understood how the vertebrate retina was working, which you couldn't do those kind of experiments until much later. So actually, the compound eye and the horseshoe crab led to the idea of lateral inhibition. And then they looked at the vertebrate eye, the mammalian eye, and realized those amacrine cells and those horizontal cells, oh, that's what can be happening in the vertebrate eye, giving lateral inhibition to the sides, and that allows us to have very good edge contrast. But it also happens in the horseshoe crab eye, and all the initial experiments were actually done in the horseshoe crab. So that got a Nobel Prize, a Hartline Nobel Prize. And where did all the work happen? Woods Hole. Okay, so that's kind of interesting. His son works in Hawaii, and he was the one that worked on those copepods I told you about. Remember the copepods from the South Pacific, the ones up by Australia and the ones by Hawaii, and that you could see the copepods, some of them had myelin, but small nerves, and the other copepod species had large axons, but no myelin, but they both could conduct really fast, so two different ways, different ways that they evolved, but also then could speed up conduction velocity. So pretty cool. All right, so we're out of the visual system. All right, so thermoregulation. We did that hot, cold, right, in the lab. And remember what we talked about? If you activated the cold receptor where you had that blue dot with electrodes, or put a real hot dot, hot nail on the blue, what did we get? What did you perceive? Pain?
Close to the veins.
Oh, close to the veins. Yes, you had mostly the receptors close to the veins. But what would happen if you activated the cold receptor with something that's really hot? You put it right on top of the blue one. What would you perceive? Cold, right? What was that cold? What was that called? Anybody remember? Paradoxal cold. It's not really cold, right? But you activated that cold receptor. You could do the same thing with electrical stimulation of the cold receptors on your hand. You could put a little electrode there and stimulate, and you'll perceive cold, but it's not really cold, not temperature cold, right? Or you can even take, like in that gum, that menthol, and put menthol on, and you would perceive cold because it activates the cold receptors. Like capsaicin would activate your hot receptors, right? That's in hot peppers. So that's kind of interesting to think about. All right. And that then goes to your brain and tells you, hey, your brain, it's hot outside, right? Or it's cold outside. But what about your body temperature? How about keeping your body temperature? You're a homeotherm. How does that happen? Does it happen from peripheral these peripheral receptors in your skin, do you think? Where does that happen? I need caffeine. All right. Anybody have an idea? Where does thermal reception take place? In your heart, lungs, kidneys?
Core body.
Core body, yes. That's important for keeping your core body temperature. Where are the sensory receptors, do you think? Anybody? Anybody? Victims, I should call names. All right, that scares people. And that raises your cortisol levels, right? Just when I say that. Remember that email we sent about public speaking? I don't know why people are so horrified by it, but it's okay. You get used to it. All right. Where do you think the thermal receptors are? Where would you want them, do you think? Maybe on the heart, right? Want to keep your heart warm. Have a warm heart. In your brain, in the hypothalamus region in your brain. But those thermoreceptors, the receptor is really no different than the receptor that's on your skin at the sensory ending. It's a trip receptor. It responds to thermal temperature. It changes its conformation and can cause that neuron to fire, right, in your skin. Well, you have those trip receptors in your brain, in the hypothalamus region, that detect the temperature of the blood going into that region. And if it gets too hot, it changes their firing frequency. If it gets too cold, they change their conformation, and that neuron changes its firing frequency. Now, this opens up a really interesting point. Do you think that neuron only fires when it's hot, or do you think it has a continuous firing frequency, like ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta, or is it shut off and then only increases its firing when it increases its warmth? What kind of system would you want to be most sensitive? What system is most sensitive? One that turns on and off, or one that has a constant firing frequency that can be modulated to go increase or decrease? What do you think? Right.
The constant firing frequency.
And that's what they found out. That gives you a higher sensitivity, right? Because a little increase means something and a little decrease means something. But if you don't have any firing, cooling it down even more, less firing, if you have zero to zero, it doesn't go anywhere, right? So that's what happens with your brain. Now, this is what happens if you eat capsaicin, the hot pepper. It's not your thermoreceptors on your lips that are telling you, I got to start sweating, right, to cool off. But that capsaicin is going into your bloodstream, going into and activating those trip receptors in your brain, and what happens? You start sweating because your body thinks you're too hot. But the temperature hasn't changed at all. But you start sweating to do what? Cool off, right? Evaporative cooling. Isn't that cool? Just eating that compound triggers that part of your brain that then causes you to start sweating? I mean, this is fascinating, right? These little things that can cause so much changes in your whole body. So that's really neat. Anyways, that's thermoreceptors for your skin. So there's a lot there that we just learned. And then in your brain. And then how is it that you have a set point at your set point, and another person might have a little different, but not much different, right? Because homeotherms, generally, we have around that temperature. And then why is it a bacterial infection raises your set point? Why is it you have a fever? Why is it, that you have that feeling? And your set point goes up, and you start sweating, right? When you get an infection, right? And your temperature's raised up. And so how does that work? Right? That's interesting. That has to do with prostaglandins, right? That are released by your immune response that you're learning in immunology now, hopefully, over there. All right, so kind of interesting stuff. Did you cover that in immunology? Thermal set point? Was it prostaglandins? Yes, right? Released from cells. And that's why you take aspirin, they inhibit the prostaglandins. Okay, so that's kind of neat to think about. Thermoreceptors out in the animal kingdom is really neat, too. Picture like a rattlesnake, they could find their prey pretty easy because the thermal receptors, they have these pits in their nose, and they can detect the temperature around them. But they found out now that these thermal receptors in, like the rattlesnake in the snakes and other reptiles, isn't really just for prey. It actually lets them know their temperature and their environment. So what they did is they put heat lamps around snakes like this, rattlesnakes, and the environment would be warm. And they would have places where the heat lamps aren't, like are a hole under a rock. And they would actually detect the temperature that they wanted. If it got too hot, they would actually seek it out. And then they could change how the temperature of that hole would change, for example, and all just give out the heat, and they would move away from it very quickly before their body temperature really changed. So it wasn't the body temperature change, it was the detection in the environment. So now they know it's not just for prey, but it's actually to sense the environment around them so they can then anticipate what would happen if they went into that environment. So that's a big change, actually, to think about perception in the environment with thermal regulation. Pretty neat. Anybody ever go to the Reptile Museum over by Natural Bridge? Reptile Museum? Natural Bridge? Nobody's ever been over there? More horrible things. What you doing in spring break? We need a field trip. In case you don't know it, and you're from Kentucky, that is a world-renowned place. It's so bizarre, that little place out there. It is a world-renowned. People from all over the world go to that little reptile museum because the guy there collects these reptiles that are poisonous from around all over, and they actually take out the venom and work with those reptiles. So if you ever get a chance, go out to that reptile museum because it's well recognized. We used to have a student a long time ago that volunteered over there. She was crazy about snakes and stuff. So she would go down and sleep on the sofa down there and work over the weekend just volunteering so she could learn more and then come back and go to school during the regular week. But anyways, pretty neat little place if you ever get a chance to go over there. Okay, so we've talked about mechano, nociceptors, pain receptors. We talked about thermoreceptors. And then we talked about kind of polymodal nociceptors that can respond to not just the mechanical stimulation, but also like chemical stimulation. So those are kind of interesting as well. That would damage your skin, for example. Okay. A little bit about pain. We talked about pain, why pain is really kind of interesting, right? Because it's subjective. Something that's painful you do might be different for another person that's not so painful. But generally, you know, if you stepped on a nail or you put a Femtech into your hand, right, you feel that pretty fast, right? Versus maybe a chemical burn or temperature burn, and you have that constant kind of slow pain that's continuing for a long time. They actually know the types of fibers that these relate to and the kind of chemicals that can activate those, like bradykinin. And then we generally think of C fibers being slow pain, but it's just that those, it's not so much their slow conduction, it's that they modulate pain, the sensory endings that are in there. But I think we kind of overemphasize slow pain, thinking that those conduction velocities really slow. It is slower, but it's not that, it's that much slower that you're feeling, oh, I don't need to move my hand away, right? It's still pretty fast when you think about it, but this is still in the literature. But the point here, too, is that the slow pain, these fibers that receive that sensory information, they don't adapt very quickly, or accommodate, we could say, right? So they keep firing. All right. And that these fast pain, fast sensory input, like touching on your skin, those go for fast conduction, those myelinated fibers. Okay, so let's look a little bit about pain modulation, then we'll get into muscle behind. We've talked about prostaglandins, right, activating these responses like proprioceptors, they enhance that pain reception. And we talk about aspirin or analgesics that can actually block prostaglandins. Let's just go to the next pictures, and this will actually summarize these points here. So if we have pain from a nociceptor that comes into your spinal cord, right, to the dorsal horn, and then that's perceived up in the brain, right? And then you might have a response from that, like lift your left leg up if you stepped on a tack. The point here is about how can you modulate that pain. And some people actually have like meditated and can handle higher pain because of the way that they've meditated to actually deal with pain. It's kind of interesting. But also, you have these endogenous opioids. And opioids, you know, like morphine and things that we've talked about, you make these in your brain. And they can then modulate the pain fibers. How do they modulate the pain fibers? Right here. In these inhibitory neurons that can project into the spinal cord where the sensory nerves project into the dorsal horn and then into the next order neurons, these neurons release chemicals that actually block the substance P, the neurotransmitter substance P that comes out of here, blocks the release of the substance P in the way of decreasing the depolarization of that presynaptic nerve terminal. And these opioids are released. So you have opioid receptors on the presynaptic nerve terminals of these sensory afferents. So if you inhibit, what happens if you inhibit the nerve terminal? If you open up chloride channels, what's going to happen to the shape of the action potential when it gets down to the nerve terminal? If you open up chloride channels and the e-chloride's down here, you're going to bring that action potential down before they can open up the voltage-gated calcium channels, right? So if you bring down the action potential and you don't allow that neuron to fire, then you can actually decrease the opening of the ideas, decrease the opening of voltage-gated calcium channels here, and then you're not going to get as much substance P released. So you make these endogenous opioids. So you might have heard of the runner's high, for example, right? The runner's high. Because they're running all the time, and then the cold winter hits, and they're like, oh, I got to run, I'm feeling crazy, you know, I need to run again, right? And this is why you see people running on these cold days out there. They want to keep running. And the idea is that they're getting the endorphins released in their body. So they're somewhat hooked on the running and the natural high that they get from endorphin release. So it's kind of interesting because there's relationship with this with drugs of abuse too, right? And pain, people that get too much pain medication, right? And then they want more and more and more and more and more and more. Maybe the idea is instead of methadone clinics or other things like this, maybe setting up exercise clinics might be a way to do this, right? But you don't see that out there. There's some ideas that this might actually help with drugs of abuse and get people exercising and actually modulate their kind of pain reception in other ways. So it's interesting. But we do want to know about that you release. So here's the take home. Substance P is released from these sensory neurons that modulate, that detect pain. They go into your spinal cord and second-order neurons. Those can be modulated by neurons from the central nervous system to release endogenous opioids and then decrease the amount of substance P released so they can decrease your pain perception. Okay, so this can all happen in your spinal cord. If you take morphine, if somebody has injected you with morphine, it's the same idea. You're now activating these receptors and you decrease the pain, say, from the surgery or whatever injury that you might have had, okay? So that's the take-home. Don't have to go too crazy with it. Those are the main things. We talked a little bit about electroreception. I know we're jumping a lot, but that's the nature of the course. The main thing to remember from this is that you have animals that can detect the electric field around them. We can't do that very well, but other animals can. Like these fish that have these ampullas along their lateral line, they can detect the electric field, but they have to make the electric field. So they have this special organ called the electric organ, right here, that can generate an electric field. But if they generate it, then they have to perceive it, right? So these particular neurons on their sides can detect this. Let me see if I go back here. I don't have a picture here. Some textbooks have a nice picture of these, but the idea is that they can detect this electric field around them, okay? And if something's in the way, like another fish or an object, it distorts that electric field. And they can detect that there's a difference on one side versus the other. So that distortion's really quite interesting. And they detect it, so they know something's right there next to them. So where would you expect these electric fish? Expect them in fresh water or salt water? Salt water, right? Conduction. And that's what happens. What's really interesting, as a side note, is this electric organ, the way that this electric organ works, a neuron fires these modified types of cells, these modified muscle cells, actually, and the nerve that innervates to these muscle cells is acetylcholine, releases acetylcholine. So what does the cell have to have if the neuron that activates it releases acetylcholine? It has to have acetylcholine receptors, right? And they have acetylcholine receptors like your acetylcholine receptors at your neuromuscular junction. So the first receptor that was isolated and crystallized to get the three-dimensional structure of a receptor for a neurotransmitter came from the electric organ. And that helped to understand the structure of your nicotinic receptors on your skeletal muscles. Why is that important? Well, if you know the structure, then you could use blockers, right? Or you might be able to design compounds that could block, say, if you had hyperactivity, for example, and you want to decrease muscle twitching or anything like that. So actually, the first isolation of the acetylcholine receptor came from the electric organ because of the high density of these receptors. They could crystallize that structure, and now they know the structure of the acetylcholine receptor, the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor, because of the electric organ and these electric fish. Magnetoreception, you probably heard about those. You know, the pigeon that can travel, or the migratory bird, for example, how do they go to the right location? And it's thought that these magnetoreception, the Earth's magnetic fields, that they can detect that. And so the magnetite that's inside of their brain, they actually know that they can receive this. And they've played all these different kind of games with magnetic fields around birds that are migratory, and it does mess them up. So a lot of interesting work on that kind of aspect. But the take-home here is that they can detect magnetic fields. People have actually put crustaceans in magnetic fields. There's one paper out, but some people say it's not true. But they've actually put crustaceans in a tank and put magnetic fields around them, and they could orientate. They would tend to orientate one way. Some people have rebuffed that kind of studies, but anyways, it's still out there as a debate if some crustaceans can detect magnetic fields. All right, so that's the main point with that. There's a lot of stuff to go over, but kind of have to move on. All right. I know there's a lot to it all, right? We got through sensory, but you can have a little course on sensory, right? That's just the way it goes. But the main points. So muscle. Muscle is so cool, right? Skeletal muscle. We think of skeletal muscle, but also heart, cardiac muscle. And you think about another muscle group in your body, which is, anybody know? For your blood vessels, for your GI tract. Smooth muscle, right? So the three major groups that we're going to be talking about. Skeletal muscle, which is also like body wall muscles in other animals. Cardiac muscle and smooth muscle. We're not going to go into too much of smooth muscle because it is complex, but we'll talk about it a little bit. Okay. Muscle generally. Skeletal muscle starts off in you as little myocytes. If you take an embryology course, we don't have one here, but it's really cool. I think EKU has one, but you can always pick up an embryology textbook, right? You don't need courses to learn stuff. You can pick up books and read it on your own. But embryology is fantastic. In us, we have these little somites. As we're a fetus developing, we have these little somites, like little balls, down as it forms around the back. And those little somites branch out, and they make your skeletal muscle. They migrate, and they make your muscle as your body grows. And those somites make up what's called these dermatomes, your banding pattern in your skin, for example, but also your skeletal muscles. So they migrate around as you develop. And like we mentioned, if you have a nerve that's inflamed or you get shingles, you might see a rash that's across your body, like a band, and that's that dermatome. That's from that one branch. And it stops right at your midline. It's amazing. It could stop right at your midline. So a rash, that's a band, and another one like that, right? So that's how your nervous system, your sensory system develops through your skin, and that's how your skeletal muscles develop as they go towards developing up these systems. So they come from myoblasts, these single cells. What's really interesting with myoblasts is they will fuse together and they will make myofibrils, or this myotube. And these are your muscle cells. So what's interesting about muscle fibers compared to other cells, they're multinucleated. They have multiple nuclei, right? Isn't that cool? Your neurons have one nuclei in them. But think, that one nuclei that's inside of your like spinal cord for your motor neuron, wow, that long axon goes all the way down to your tip of your toe, right? That's a long ways to make proteins and then migrate all the way down there and then, you know, back and forth. Here we have a muscle fiber that's multinucleated, all right? And then some of these cells don't turn into muscle fibers right away. They stay on the surface of the muscle fiber, the single cell. They're called satellite cells because they're like an extra body, a satellite, you know, like in space, an extra body that's next to it. And what's really interesting is these satellite cells can then invade into the muscle cell and become muscle cells. In development, these satellite cells are very important because they can add in and they can help your muscle develop. They found them in adults. But if you knock out the adults of satellite cells, they don't really have a role anymore as adults. They don't really understand why we need them as adults, because you can knock them out and your muscle cells don't really, they don't grow. They don't go inside the muscle cell to make growth. They're not necessary. There's a whole group here, the Center of Muscle Biology, that actually studies this. Charlotte Peterson, she's really good about this. Anybody wants to work in labs and understand about muscle research, there's a whole Center of Muscle Biology here. Cardiovascular researchers, as well as skeletal muscle research. And they address these factors right here. Every Thursday, if you want to, there's a muscle forum, a seminar on muscles over at the Health Science Center. And so on Thursdays, that's why I tail it out of here pretty quickly, because we go to listen about muscle research every Thursday, 11 to 12. And you're always welcome. Okay, so this is the topics that they are interested in right now. Very important, right? If you had a heart attack and some muscle cells that are dead, maybe how could you repair that heart, right? So stem cells are an interesting topic, but also for your skeletal muscle cells. So what do we have to know here? Is that these muscle cells, the single cells, multinucleated, they can be multiple muscle cells, single cells together, and then wrapped around with like a fascia that goes around it. And it's really quite interesting. And then all those make up your muscle fibers. bigger muscle fibers. So let's look at a cross-section. You could see these like this, and you have a nucleus inside of the cell, and then you have satellite cells that are underneath the basal lamina of that muscle fiber. And those can invade during development and actually incorporate nuclei inside of that muscle fiber. So that's kind of interesting. But here's kind of the crux of the problems that we've just talked about in this figure here. So embryonic muscle, myoblast, turn into myotubes. Myotubes make up these single muscle fibers. So these are the single cells. The muscle fibers are the single cells. Those muscle fibers come together, and they can make this whole muscle unit that we've been looking at. But if you take out this muscle fiber and you look at inside of the muscle fiber, inside of the single cell, you can see the myofibril. And the myofibril has this nice banding pattern in skeletal muscle and in cardiac. We'll talk a little bit about it. But this is the fundamental unit inside of the muscle fiber, these myofibrils. If we look at the myofibril, there's a banding pattern that's really quite interesting. So people noticed this years ago, but they didn't understand how it worked. The structure's there, but they wanted to know how is that structure related to muscle function. So what would you think you would do? You would want to look at the structure of this when a muscle stretched, or you stimulated it and it contracted. And the banding pattern changed. Whoa! So what do you think? There's something to do with that banding pattern and force generation. So this is where the research has gone on for many years. The general idea, and you need to know this, are these structures. If you looked at the sarcomere, so a sarcomere is defined as from a Z-line or a Z-disc to a Z-disc. That's one sarcomere. All right. Inside that sarcomere, we need to know the anatomy. Inside of that sarcomere, and we're going to go over this again and again, you have on the Z-disc, so you think of it like your thumbs, like a Z-disc, and then you think your fingers. And the fingers are actin, all right? And the Z-disc are like your thumbs sticking up. And then you have a structure that's in between there, like this pen, that's the myosin. And in that pen, there are little heads, myosin heads. Some are shaped this way on this side, and some are like this on this side. So what happens is those little heads bind to the actin and shorten it. Shorten the sarcomere, right? Z-disc to Z-disc is my thumb to thumb. Then the sarcomere shortens, right? So what happened? Did the actin shorten? No, right? It's still right here. If it overlaps, then you might think it shortens. Did the myosin shorten? Did the pen shorten when it contracted? No. So the myosin didn't shorten. Why I do this visual demonstration is that you can do that during the exam. And if you know that pen equals myosin, and when you get the question, does the A-band, which is the myosin, shorten during muscle contraction? No, right? So you get that down. So, you know, try to relate that visually if you have to and redraw that out on the test, because we're going to know these banding patterns. Okay, so we can go through these. And what's kind of neat is historically, and we're going to go back over the banding patterns in a little bit, people took cross-sections of the muscle fiber, and they looked at it in cross-section. And because of the cross-sections, they figured out what's happening with the muscle as it contracts. Because look, if you take a cross-section across this myosin in the middle, you just see the myosin. If you take a cross-section towards the Z-disc, then you see just the actin around the myosin, like my fingers that were around that. But my fingers were like two-dimensional. This is three-dimensional. But if you take it not just right close to the Z-disc, but a little bit where you get the myosin in the actin, you see this structure. So what they did is they took cross-sections of the muscle in a relaxed state when it's all stretched out, took multiple cross-sections, and then they could contract it. And they took multiple cross-sections. Because of the anatomy, the three-dimensional anatomy that they looked at in the cross-sections, they came up with the muscle must slide over that bigger element that's in the middle. So this is what's called the sliding filament hypothesis. The sliding filament hypothesis. It was all based on the anatomy that was done. We have an educational model in this that we take to middle schools and actually have them look at the structure, like these cross sections, and then come up with how do they think this model works. And they build little models with pipe cleaners and stuff like that. So it's really quite cool. But they've got the idea down about how muscle works. And we actually show them sarcomeres on slides. So we go to the supermarket, take beef muscle, take fish muscle, take chicken muscle, take it thin, push it down on a slide, put a cover glass on it, and you can see the banding pattern. And what's really cool is the kids say, oh, they say, which muscle's which? Which one's from the chicken? Which one's from the cow? Which one's from the fish or the chicken? You know, and they look through all the different sarcomeres, and they say, they all look the same. Exactly, right? So that's kind of interesting. And you can look at it in a fruit fly, and it looks the same as well. Okay, so what do we have to know? You don't have to memorize all these different numbers. If you did take the muscle course, you would have to know all this, but you don't have to know this here, right? It's that the myosin is made up of these multiple units that come together, and it's really quite a minute. And here are the little heads. You can disassociate the myosin with glycerol, get it into a solution like a saline, and you can take away the glycerol, and guess what? The myosin self-forms again, just like it did originally. And it's really quite interesting. People are trying to figure out, how does it do that? It's amazing, but it can do that. And so you can get back to the myosin filament by disassociating them, let the myosins kind of go back together, and they'll reform the myosin filament. That's interesting because of the developmental aspect. How does your muscle grow with exercise? When you think about that, just stop and think about that for a second. Wow, your muscle has got all this contractile stuff in there, right? Nuclei. And then if you exercise, your muscle gets bigger. It has to add in contractile elements to get bigger. It's not that you add in more muscle fibers. Your muscle doesn't increase in muscle numbers of muscle fibers, number of muscle cells, as you exercise, for example. The size of the muscle fiber itself gets bigger. Why does it get bigger? More contractile elements in there. But think about it. You're adding contractile elements to a muscle that's working. How do you add in all that arrangement while the muscle's working? If you stop exercising or you cut your nerve, you know if you cut the nerve to your muscle, in 20 minutes your muscle will start to degrade. It will already start breaking down within 20 minutes of cutting that nerve to your muscle fiber. Bed rest, bad things. Because your muscles will degrade, and they'll degrade quite quickly within an activity. That's why in the ICU unit now, even very sick people that got tubes all around them, in their nose and inside their body, they will get them up out of bed, make them sit on the edge of the bed, and start ambulating.
I'm a rehab tech, so I do that.
Oh, you do that rehab. So you're in the ICU, and you, are you working here?
Yeah.
Do you work with Gerald Spinunsky? He has a bicycle.
Oh, is he a PT?
No, he's a pulmonologist.
Oh, okay. I know about the little bike thing.
Okay, so at UK, Gerald Spinunsky is doing some really neat work, and he takes people to rotate. He's in our muscle group, too. He's really interested very much in the diaphragm muscle, because when you go on a ventilator, like you can't breathe, right? You go on a ventilator, let's say you had an injury or something, and then guess what happens to your diaphragm when you're dependent on a ventilator breathing for you, pushing air in your lungs and out of your lungs, in your lungs and out of your lungs. You're not using your diaphragm anymore. Guess what happens to the diaphragm? It atrophies very fast. How are you ever going to get off the ventilator? If your diaphragm is atrophying, when they take the ventilator off, you try to breathe in, you can't breathe, right? Because your muscle's too weak. So the ventilators are made to be assist ventilators versus full ventilation. But the idea is, how can you let the body continue to exercise that so much, or don't keep them very long on a ventilator? A lot of people are on ventilators for the rest of their life. There's a whole place down in Somerset, Kentucky, right? In case you know about this, there's people just all on ventilators. It's a ventilator therapy place. And people are sent there from all over Kentucky, and they're just on ventilators for the rest of their life. Really bad situation. But a lot of those people probably didn't have to be there from the studies that they now know. So Gerald Spinunsky, just as we're talking about muscle, does some fantastic research. So he asked, and he's published this, and he talks about it publicly. He asked the other docs in the ICU here at UK, what's the respiratory function of you? You know, of that patient, this patient, that patient, that patient. Why are they on the ventilator at the rate that you determined? And guess what he got? So he did the study. He asked them, and he wanted to score. What's their respiratory function? I want a number, right? Because if you can't express biological systems in numbers, math, you're not there yet in the science. He wants a number. It's like your pH. What's your pH? What's your osmolarity? What's all that, right? A number. And the person would say, oh, I think he's a 2. Not very good. And this person would say, oh, I think he's, you know, about a 9 or a 10. Maybe needs some assist. And the other person, maybe a 5. Okay. What made you come up with those numbers? Where's your index for that? Where's your test for that? Kind of a gut response. You know, I've been doing this for 20 years or something. It's my gut response. Okay. So he said, no, we're going to test this. We're going to get an index. So he would do this to himself. And he would talk to the patients or their family members and say, we need to do a test on your patient, on your family member. And he would get them to sign consents. But he would do this to show the family. He would actually put electrodes on his nerve, on his neck, that would stimulate the diaphragm. While he has a monitor in his mouth, switch in his mouth, he would shock himself, make his diaphragm contract, and he could measure the vacuum that when the diaphragm contracts and pulls down, it would pull your lungs open, right? And pull air in. So he would get an index from stimulating that nerve that controls your diaphragm. And now he had an index. And then he would match it with what the physicians have said for their patients. And guess what? It was no better than random. You could take a person off the street and tell them to index those patients in the ICU, and they would do just as well as the physicians that are pulmonologists. Wow. That's bad, right? So he actually is trying to implement this to get an index of the patients that do they need the full respiratory function? Do they need the full ventilator? Or could we just assist them to do it? This tells you, you know, we're still at a very infancy in understanding medicine and health. And this kind of drives you to keep involved in the research aspects of it as well, and index things. So that's really interesting. The take home here is diaphragm atrophies very quickly. And so do your other muscles. So it's kind of interesting. How do you have a functional muscle if you're not using it? How does it atrophy? These contractile elements degrade. Which ones degrade? Do they all degrade together? But it still has to function, right? It's still contracting. Let's say you start to become a couch potato and you start watching those series on TV, you know, like all 20 hours of it or something like that. And your muscles are probably degrading sitting there on the sofa. And so how is it degrading but allowing it to still function? Is that not amazing? That's amazing, right? So those proteins degrade down to amino acids and they can get out of the cell and go into your bloodstream and, you know, all that kind of interesting aspects, right? Or if you're starving to death, right, and you're not eating, they'll actually break down muscle mass, but you can still contract. How does that happen in a functional muscle? Is that not interesting? Guess what? The idea of how muscle builds and degrades and can rebuild, the primary studies of that, understanding that came out of Harvard, came out of a lab that worked with Drosophila muscles. Drosophila fruit fly larval muscles. And they actually now understand how the elements come together in development and actually degrade muscle from work that was done in Drosophila. Isn't that phenomenal? That's really phenomenal. Okay, so what do we have to know? Just showing you some fun pictures of muscles. We do have to know, in case you see a picture like this on an exam, we are going to have to know what a sarcomere is. We're going to have to know this banding pattern. We're going to go over this over and over again. The myosin, this thicker element here in the middle, between the Z-disc, this is your myosin. The H-zone is the region where your two fingers, the tips of your two fingers are, right, in this condition. So H, right down here, it looks like an H, doesn't it? If I just look at the two fingers on both sides and the pen in the middle, doesn't it look like an H? And this is the bridge. So that's the H zone, okay? The blue, the pen, is the A zone, right? So between the two ends of the actin, if we have a sliding filament, they shorten, right? They get closer together. So think about what's happening to this, the banding pattern. The I band goes across the Z disc. So you have to know the I band because it's going from the, and when we say draw three sarcomeres, it's to help you on the open response type of question. Because if you draw one sarcomere from Z disc to Z disc, where's the I band? You get confused, right? Because the I band goes from this into this myosin to the next one that's here. Or you could say this is a half a I band. Right, this is a half I band. The other half is over here, right, in one sarcomere. So the I band goes across the Z disc and goes into the next sarcomere to the end of this myosin. So I think, you know, moving your hands around will really help you to see these. What's really interesting is you can take out single muscle cells and you can study this banding pattern and you can look at the sarcomeres right there. Bam, 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 bam. And one of the elements that's been most used to isolate myosin and understand the muscle fiber, guess what, has come from a comparative studies using tarantula muscle. Is that not bizarre? Tarantula body wall muscle has given the best understanding of some of the myosin heads and the structures of three-dimensional structures where they can actually look at it, because it just holds together really well. I know we have to stop here. But do go through, and we're going to continue with the sarcomere, and we're going to go pretty quickly through this chapter. All these PowerPoints are up online on your webpage as well as on campus.